This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hello and welcome back to Close Reads here on the Close Reads Podcast Network. I am David Kern, actually not sitting in my car for once. I'm sitting in my bedroom at home, and joining me on the Zoom line are Tim McIntosh and Heidi White, my old friends. Tim, Heidi, how's it going? Welcome back.
Thank you, David.
It's going great. I'm really happy that you're not in your car right now. The chance of you seeing wildlife is a little slimmer, I guess. That was exciting.
Well, I'm looking out my back window and we are surrounded by some trees and stuff. So we may see, I will at least see birds and squirrels. I'm pretty confident of that. And possibly my children when they get home, who probably will start running around the backyard like wildlife
indeed.
Wild creatures. Hey, Tim, are you back home yet or are you still braving the basement?
Still braving the basement. I just took a picture. I've now developed a stand-up desk, which is the dryer in the laundry room basement.
So this would be a good time then to turn on video and record the whole thing.
This would be a great video time conversation. For that. Like you can't really imagine a more dank situation for recording.
I mean, I could think of a few. Like, imagine the prison that the guy in the Count of Monte Cristo got thrown in for a long time. Ooh. Like, if that had power and Wi-Fi, that would be more dank.
The tunnel that leads to Mount Doom in the Two Towers might be a bit more dank.
That's the kind of wildlife that you can expect to see if you're in Tim's situation.
Or
She-Lob.
I forgot She-Lob.
The Underground from Notes from the Underground.
Ooh. Oh,
there you go. Dostoevsky reference. I like it.
Gosh, I wish that we could do a Dostoevsky book. Oh, wait, we are.
Which actually is a good transition because it gives me a chance to remind people that we have the bonus Crime and Punishment conversations that are happening right now. And as a matter of fact, as soon as I'm done recording here, I will be uploading the newest episode to Patreon. So if you head over to patreon.com/closereads, you will be able to access those bonus podcasts. If you are a subscriber, if you're supporting the show that way, you're also getting that sweet show swag if you're doing that. Don't forget, you can follow along and join the conversation on social media, on Facebook. You can join the Close Reads podcast discussion group on Instagram. You can follow us at Close Reads Pods, and you can follow the newsletter at closereads.substack.com. There has been lots of great conversation on the Facebook page about Anne of Green Gables. And of course, we are here to answer your questions about Anne of Green Gables. I got to say, I'm a little sad to be done.
Yeah.
Know, right?
When we first started working through the book, I was thinking, man, I really stretched this out. And then I started feeling glad that we did that as far as the schedule goes because of, this strange quarantine.
Nice.
So it was a good, I think it was good timing. Fortuitous providential timing to be reading Anne of Green Gables as this strange time was happening. Up next is Graham Greene's The End of the Affair. And I'm not so sure that timing is as providential or at least as beneficial. I guess all timing is providential, no. That it's not, maybe it's going to be a little more dour. When I posted the image on Instagram with the schedule, the reading schedule, there were some, can't wait to be depressed comments. A common response to Graham Greene books. And yet, I think that there'll be some great conversations. The Power and the Glory series was one of our more popular ones. And I think that the End of the Affair conversations will be really good as well. And next week, we will kick off that by talking about book one of Graham Greene's The End of the Affair. So if you haven't started that, then now's your chance to do so.
And I have to say, I think there might be a tie-in, David. Like one of the crucial moments in that book, I won't give anything away, happens during, after,
is it to happen in a dank
bomb
place?
Shelter. It happens in a dank place in is it in a bombing shelter or like returning from a bombing shelter during the Nazi blitz of London? So just
that's it's certainly bomb shelter adjacent.
It's definitely bomb shelter adjacent. Yeah.
There are lots of bombs dropped in that book. That is very true. So next week we will kick off that conversation talking about book one, and we will have that up on 1 week from today, which is May 5th. Okay, let's talk about some questions relating to Anne of Green Gables. There were plenty of whimsical questions. Tim was mentioning before we started recording that there were that the questions fit the book, which I think is, you know, makes sense given our listenership and the Close Reads community. I want to start with one though that is neither whimsical nor what's the opposite of whimsical?
Dour.
Unwhimsical.
I don't even know.
Dour, yeah. Somebody asked on the Instagram page if any of us have seen and have any thoughts about the Anne with an E series on Netflix, because we've talked a lot about the classic one that, you know, Canadian television did back in the 80s, which we're going to talk about in conjunction with The Last Dance in May. But have either of you seen the Netflix series? Because I have not seen it. Tim, I'm going to assume you have not seen it.
No, I have not seen it.
No. So if I love a book, I will absolutely not watch any adaptation of it before I get feedback from various sources. So the Little Women, I had my doubts about it. And to be honest, I still haven't seen it because I'm reading it aloud to Lucy right now. And we've agreed not to watch the movie till we're through the read aloud. But I can't wait to see it because I've gotten so much positive feedback, including from the two of you. But when it first was announced, I was like, I don't know. So I have heard next to nothing about Anne with an E that would indicate that it is worth seeing as a fan of the book as it is written. So I don't plan on watching it. So I can't comment, but my understanding from what I've read and heard from people who have seen it is that it's a very modern adaptation in that they try to make it more realistic. Like they take the capital R romantic element out of it and try to make it so that Anne is a typical traumatized child.
Huh.
And they focus, like they have written this whole backstory about her life before that then is brought into her experience in Avonlea. And I don't think as a plot point, like I said, I haven't seen it. I don't think it's as meaning that those people come to Avonlea, but that her experience of trauma informs the story way more. And so does everybody else's, you know, Matthew and Marilla and everybody too. So they're trying to like make it gritty is my understanding.
Sounds like a different book.
Yeah. So I would say that in some ways violates the soul of the story. And that is troubling to me because I love it. And because I'm actually just frankly really tired of modern adaptations trying to make everything gritty. Like that's fine sometimes, but I'm kind of over that. And I just am not interested in watching it. But like I said, I haven't seen it. So maybe somebody can convince me to see it, but I doubt it.
Okay, well, let's dive into the questions that were posted here. Should we start with Jesse Brown's or no? Let's start with Jesse Brown's.
Only if Tim answers it first.
Has there ever been a cuter boy than Gilbert Blythe, and why not?
Okay, I have an answer for this, and I'm actually afraid that no one is going to like it. So the answer is no, as the question requires. But let me just kind of point out something that's a little bit... that I think that not many people want to hear. I'm like an Anne of Green Gables truther all of a sudden. There is no boy that is cuter than Gilbert Blythe. And Gilbert Blythe has about 5 lines in the entire book.
Mm-hmm. True.
It's like this, I believe that oftentimes that is a stipulation for cuteness, isn't it?
I am afraid it is.
Can you go
well,
on?
I just want that to kind of like sit for a little while. Linger yeah.
Yeah. Right. I don't feel like I should. I feel like Tim and I have both implied certain realities that we shouldn't have to explain right now.
All right.
I feel like under this, there's subtext within what we said, right, Tim?
Absolutely right, David. I kind of feel like since Jesse asked a question, which according to every logic textbook was fits the definition of the loaded question, I think we should invite Jesse on to answer that question. Or to kind of like defend the claim to Gilbert's cuteness, and to also kind of reconcile that with the fact that he has 5 total lines in the whole book.
Well, as the follow-up comments to her comment on, as the thread indicates, most people were just thinking about Jonathan Crombie, who played the actor in the movie.
Is that what people were thinking? The actor who played the character.
I'm pretty sure that's basically, there's lots of Jonathan Crombieites out there on the thread and also just on the internet. So, you'll understand when you watch.
Oh, really? I'll be like, I get it now. I'm no longer an Anne of Green Gables truther. Now I'm like fully bought in.
I mean, is the nature of a truther to just state facts and then let the subtext be what it is? That doesn't feel like what a truther does.
No, I think that's what truthers do. Like, I mean, I think you kind of roll out with something like, I'm not going to give a specific example. I'll make up an example. Oh, you really think the bubonic plague happened? Huh.
You really think we landed on the moon? You really think the world's
seriously,
round?
It's like if you ask a rhetorical question and you just kind of let it sit. So that's what I just did. Oh, really? Gilbert Blythe is the cutest boy ever and he had 5 lines? Huh.
Yeah, but implicit in the bubonic plague example is the suggestion that it didn't happen. Well, you're just stating the fact that he only had 5 lines. You're stating actual facts.
I think I'm actually...
I don't know. Why are we talking about this?
It's completely my fault. I think what I am implying, I'm going to disrobe the rhetorical question now, and the whole device is just completely lost.
Sounds
I know,
scandalous.
It does sound scandalous. It's more kind of embarrassing.
It's like the emperor is what it is. It's not scandalous. It's like the emperor is blind to his own foibles and he's marching down the middle of the rhetorical street.
And I just wonder if part of the prerequisites for cuteness might be one never opens one's mouth. That's the rhetorical implication.
I guess it depends on what your teeth look like, but yeah.
Let's move on. I feel like I've ruined that. Like I've ruined a perfectly delightful question because I love that question.
I think that we went on. I think we took it in the right direction.
Okay.
Linda wants to know, has there ever been a more soul-enriching book for readers of all ages than Anne of Green Gables, or why not? Which now we're starting to see a trend that Jesse Brown has started here. So do you think, I kind of feel like what we have done on this podcast is discuss why this is a soul-enriching book for readers of all ages. Mm-hmm. And so maybe what we're getting from Linda there is just some affirmation that I wanted to just point out and thank her for.
Yes. It is a both of those are comments dressed as a question. And this is what the disrobing of Tim McIntosh has revealed.
Whoa, hold on.
No, let's go with it. Let's just let that land.
Let's
disrobing land.
The preposition there was important.
I know. I totally agree. What's one of those, like, you can't take it back unless Logan does, which he won't, because why
to
would
be
he?
Fair, though, we might now understand why Tim is leaning on a washing machine.
That might explain. Yeah, it really might. And given my corona hair, like, if you guys could see my corona hair, that would also,
Christina has a question for Tim. And then there were some follow-ups for all of us. So we'll start with Christina's question for Tim, and then Heidi and I will respond to it as well. And the question is, what other books, Tim, have surprised you and won you over as much as Anne did? It's been a joy to listen to you discover Anne and be won over by her charms. I'd love to know if other stories you read out of obligation have had that same enchanting effect. So, Tim, go ahead. And then Heidi, go ahead. And while you guys are talking, I've got to go do something real quick. And then I will respond after that if you are not sitting there silently and waiting for me. So Tim, go ahead.
So I'm going to make this brief. Just kidding, David. Just kidding. I'm not going to make this brief.
Don't make it brief. That's not helpful.
Before you went to do your errand.
the one time when I need you not to be brief.
It's be verbose.
I thought about this question, Heidi, for a long time, and I don't really have a great answer. I even scanned.
So you really are going to be brief?
No, well, I'm going to give two possible examples. One of them is a book that we're actually going to read this year on Close Reads, The Sun Also Rises. And I'm kind of happy that I can give this preface to that book, because I'm a little bit afraid that book's going to scare people off, because my students, when they read it, would frequently remark, "Nothing happens in this book," you know, because it doesn't really seem like anything is happening in the book. And I approached that book with a similar kind of mindset, like, nothing happens in this book. And I was in college and I was not the brightest bulb in the store. Is that the metaphor? But I loved that book. And I continue to love that book. I think it's an all-time classic. And I'll give a variation of an answer that, or a variation reply to that question. I read a book called The Heart of Darkness by Joseph Conrad, and I hated it. I mean, I cannot tell you how much I hated that book. It was only, it's like 75 pages, and it was a slog. Every moment of it was a slog. And I wrote a paper that I actually put a lot of effort into it. And one of my beloved professors, Whit Jones, a shout out. And I'm going to actually thank Whit Jones on the air, because he gave me an F, and I deserved it. It was a bomb of paper. And I went back to him and I was like, "Hey, what?" And he gave me an opportunity to rewrite it, you know, with some stipulations. I got a D the next time. Like, that's how badly I did on the essay. But it woke me up. I was like, "Oh, wow, I'm right. I'm trying to like summarize an entire book in a book of, in a 4-page essay of literary criticism. And it's one of the most complex books, you know, that like we still read, that's over 100 years old." Those are the best examples that I could come up with, Heidi. Do you have any examples?
Well, I have a follow-up question to your examples. So the question was, what books have you read that you thought you weren't going to like, but then you did? Yeah. And then you answered it with a book that you thought you were going to like, but you hated. So,
oh no, sorry, I set it up wrong. I thought I was gonna hate The Sun Also Rises, and I loved it. I set it up wrong.
Heart of Darkness.
Yeah, I forgot the end second
of that story.
I'm so sorry, I forgot the second part of it. This is like I'm being a terrible commentator.
Well, that's why you have such, you know, helpful colleagues.
Thank you very much.
You're
a playwright.
David fished him out of this. He's lost in the laundry room somewhere. He's like off the rails.
It was definitely Heidi White that fished you out of this. And also, everybody should know that David's errand he had to run was getting food.
So. Oh yeah, no, it's very true. My blood sugar like crashed. Yeah.
Oh wow,
I haven't eaten anything today because I've been busy, and I'm sitting here talking and. All of a sudden, I was like, whoa, I don't know if I can see. I mean, it wasn't like that bad, but it was, I definitely don't know if I'm going to make it through the next hour at a high energy pace, which this podcast seems like it's going to demand of me if I don't go get some supplies.
No, you needed that. And now you're going to nibble on like 3 bites, and that's going to really help.
No, I went and got...
David's in the coronavirus mindset. It's not food he got. It's not food. It's supplies. I got supplies for the long journey underground.
I'm having the best time on this podcast.
What do you normally call the food that you bring with you?
Food. You call it food. Or you get particular with it. I got myself
even
lasagna.
When you're podcasting?
Even when you're podcasting, you go with the specifics.
Tim.
My vegetable lasagna. I took a little time to warm up my vegetable lasagna.
Tim, and what this is revealing is that some of us are poets and some of us aren't.
So can I hear the rest of this Heart of Darkness story?
So I returned after several years of basically using Heart of Darkness as a synonym for just like crappy, like literary snob writing. And I returned to it because, I'll be honest, I had to teach it for school. I had to teach it at Gutenberg. And I actually fought for it to be taught at Gutenberg because I kind of like recognized that it spoke to colonialism and like our curriculum just like didn't have like a strong kind of representation of like the effects of colonialism in literature. And so I reread it and I was like, oh gosh, what have I done? This is a really good book. It still kind of makes me want to pull my hair out because it's so frustrating to read, but I actually enjoyed it. And I got to admit, it's a really, really fine book. That's the best I can do. Okay. So
the conclusion is Heart of Darkness is good.
Heart of Darkness might even be worth reading on close reads, but I think we would need to kind of bracket it or bookend it with a couple of like just really pleasant reads.
Sun, maybe The Sun Also Rises and Blood Meridian.
Oh gosh. Oh my gosh.
Moby Dick.
How did you guys lose half your listenership? Let me tell you.
It was the summer of Blood Meridian, Moby Dick, and Heart of Darkness.
Yeah.
Talk about a dank place where you need supplies. Heidi, what about you? What's a book that you were enchanted by that you thought was going to be perhaps not as enchanting?
Well, I have two, and one is The Spy Who Came in from the Cold.
Oh!
I loved that book, and I mean, we talked about this quite a bit when we were recording the podcast. I'd never read spy novels before, and I loved it. I thought it was delightful, and I loved the writing. It is very literary writing, but I liked the puzzle of it. I liked the psychological study of it. I liked the twist. It completely got me. I had no idea it was coming. So I thought it was great. And I love him as an author. And yeah, read through.
You've since now read that. How much have you read now of his books?
I think I read.
I mean, he's written like 35 or something.
Yeah, so. And I haven't read his entire canon. I think I read 6. And my favorite was A Perfect Spy, although that still depresses me every time I think about it. But but I loved it. So
yeah.
That was one. And then it wasn't that I didn't expect to like it. It's that I didn't expect to love it. You know, I didn't think I would love it. I thought like, I will read it and I'll appreciate it. And there'll be things I like about it. And instead it just enthralled me from start to finish. And also my second one is not close reads related. It is, and I think I've said this before, but it is Lincoln in the Bardo by George Saunders. I had to read that because I was interviewing him and I didn't want to. I was really grumpy about it. I thought it was going to be this like postmodern slog. And I loved it. Like from the first page. And it's actually a hard novel to read. It's have you all read it? I have recommended it to you like 500 times.
Yeah.
Tim. But David, have you read Lincoln and the Bardo? I know you've read George Saunders.
I haven't read all of Lincoln and the Bardo. I've read like one of those weird books where I've just read bits and pieces. I just haven't gotten to it yet.
Well, it's hard to read. It's an investment. It takes about 30 pages, honestly, to even know what's going on. And so I'll just say what it is. There are ghosts in this graveyard, and it's little bits of inner monologue from these ghosts that are stuck in this graveyard. And the premise of the novel is that Abraham Lincoln has lost his son, Willie Lincoln, which is true. Willie Lincoln died at age 11 of a sickness in his parents' house while his parents were downstairs at a state dinner. That's true. And
isn't the Civil War still going on when he died?
It's the second year of the Civil War.
Can you imagine?
Like, it's absolute, like the pressure on Lincoln, both as the president and then personally with his marriage falling apart and his child dying unexpected. The doctors had told Lincoln that Willie would recover and then he just died. Like it's horrifying. And so George Saunders was like obsessed with this idea and he connected it with he said every time that he looks at a Pietà, he thinks about this moment in Lincoln's life. So he wrote a novel about it of these. And then one night Lincoln, and this is not giving away too much of the story. It's actually helpful because the story is kind of hard to read. So one night Lincoln went to his son's grave. He was buried in a sarcophagus. So you had to go inside and inside a tiny building. And he stayed there all night one night. And nobody knows what happened in there. And so the book is a speculation of what Lincoln was doing. And then the ghosts that are stuck in the graveyard that can't be seen are watching this happen.
Oh my gosh.
It's the most powerful novel I think I've read in the last probably 10 years. I was absolutely captivated by it. I loved it. It was so powerful. And I didn't want to read it at all because it was a modern story. It was just reverse chronological snobbery on my part. I thought nobody could write a book that good today. And it was so good. It's great. So anyway.
Well, those are good answers.
We have derailed again, but I guess that was an actual question. So,
and also I asked you to derail.
Yes. So,
I mean, you accomplished what I...
David, how about you?
It's a tough question because what I was trying to think, like while you guys were talking, I was trying to think about what exactly we mean by like enchanted, because so like True Grit, for example, when I first read it, I did not expect it to be what it was, right? And I like Western stories, but the degree to which I found her voice, like the narrator's voice enchanting, was really surprising to me. You know, it was a different book than what I expected. So, you know, now I love it, but back when I read it the first time, it wasn't that I thought I was going to dislike it though. So, you know, what do we mean by more enchanting than we thought it was going to be? Recently, also related to Abraham Lincoln, actually, I've talked about it a lot, but Morris Manning's collection of poetry, Rail Splitter, I found to be, I was intrigued by the concept because it's about Abraham Lincoln. It's poems from the perspective of Abraham Lincoln after he's been killed. But the degree to which it was enchanting to me was surprising. And then it happens to me fairly often with reading children's books to the kids. Like when I read Jonathan Rogers' series of books to the kids, the degree to which, especially the last two books, was enchanting to me, even as an adult, I think was really surprising. It's not that I thought Jonathan Rogers wasn't a good writer, but sometimes you come across a book that for you as an adult, you're just completely taken by, almost in the same way that your kids are. And those are kind of fun, enchanting moments for a parent when you're kind of like right there along with the kids and you want to read the next chapter as much as they want to hear it. So those are good moments. I get it. I'm kind of easily enchanted by books, if I'm being honest. So it's kind of a tough question. Hey, Heidi, if you had a dollar for every time you read Anne, what would you buy? We know that you're up to you're up to 1,311 reads by my count. So Christina Scott wants to know that.
Well, this is a relevant question for me because of how many times I've read Anne of Green Gables and because it was just my birthday. And so I've been thinking a lot about things I want to own. And I think I would buy... this is such a hard question. So I would definitely buy rose bushes. That's what I would buy. I have my, cause I'm gardening this year and I'm obsessed with rose bushes right now. And it turns out they're really expensive and I want them all along the border of my porch, which Tim sat on my porch before. It's a big porch.
Yeah.
David, your day is coming. And
we'll see.
We'll sit outside and, make s'mores and be surrounded by rose bushes that I will buy because I feel like that's a very fitting thing.
And have Jack quote a Shakespeare sonnet to you.
Yeah, that's right.
That's what happened to me. Yeah. That was a moment.
It was a moment. But there was no smell of roses lingering in the air, which there will be in the future with all of my earnings that I will get from reading Anne of Green Gables.
I would like to know where the money is coming from. Like in this scenario, who is passing the dollar down to you for every time that you've read Anne? Because I was thinking about it and I was thinking, that's a good deal to get a dollar every time you've read Anne. And then I thought about it and I was like, that's actually a terrible deal. Like that the amount of hours you have to put in to read the book for $1 is not really a great investment, except, I mean, if you're just thinking in purely financial terms. So the real question is, what would you do if you had $100 for every time you read Anne?
Oh.
Buy extra rose bushes?
No. I mean, I would, and so we're building a greenhouse and I would spend it on that for sure. $100. I would have so much money.
You would be rich.
I mean, I do want this to happen.
Who do we talk to? how do we make this happen?
All right. Kristen Duckworth asks, is there an equivalent to Anne for boys, a book that is universally loved and so formative to so many of us like that? Harry Potter comes to mind, mm-hmm. but are there any other classics?
Okay, but wait, Harry Potter, it's not... I think of Anne of Green Gables that its readership is overwhelmingly female.
Yeah.
I don't think that's true for Harry Potter.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you mean because you mean that it's not just boys who read Harry Potter, is what you're saying? Yeah. Yeah. It does seem like a lot of the, what do you guys think?
I will propose... And I'm not going to say that it has like the same gender imbalance as I presume Anne of Green Gables has. I'm going to propose Old Yeller.
Well, that's interesting. That had not occurred to me.
I still think that book, there's a more equal balance. Like I know plenty of women and young women who have read that book and who love that book.
Do you think... This is interesting. Why do you think that this is, though? Because even if you think about... some of the books that people responded to was, say, Tom Sawyer, Huck Finn, Little Britches, Farmer Boy. Those are the answers I see a couple times here. But to your point, those books are not read by just boys. Do you think that is something to do with like that they're just the way we talk about gender, or is it a matter of the way we talk about books?
That's a good question.
Sorry, I stumbled through that because in my head, I'm like trying to think of, you know.
Yeah, right. All these different factors.
Yeah.
I have a, Heidi, I think you've got an idea about this also. I wonder if it's.
No. Go ahead. Please.
I mean, I would think that the number of authors previous to the 20th century and maybe even the second half of the 20th century, like in the history of English publishing, I'm going to guess 90-10 male to female. I mean, I think part of the...
In terms of authorship?
Yeah. And so I think part of the delight of Anne of Green Gables is that it's not just a female protagonist. It's also a female author who, to my way of saying it, like really one of the like chief delights of the book is that she captures this young female perspective. And I just don't know that there's many other books like that, like written previous to the 1960s. I mean, it's just more like it's a problem of a gender imbalance in authorship.
Yeah, I mean, you get Jane Austen, Louise May Alcott, and you know, Lucy Maud Montgomery, and there are a few others, but especially ones written for young women. You know, you had in the early late 18. You had Luella Cathers. And, you know, people like that, but they weren't writing really like specifically for young women
or
for girls. I'm trying to think like, what about like the Penrod books? But those, I guess, are, I mean, those aren't really politically correct anymore, but those might've been anything by Booth Tarkington, I guess, might've been, for boys more.
Well, I think
Farmer Boy might be a good one.
I think so. I think there's a lot, but that because of there is some cultural pressure to suppress those voices that are speaking directly to the development of kind of the adventurous spirit of a boy.
You mean like today? Yes, there are?
Yes. So there's plenty of room still for Anne of Green Gables. And you know, but there's not as much room for say that. How is it Howard Pyle's version of Men of Iron? Like that, like that was those stories, like the stories of King Arthur's knights were a really big deal in our house when Jack was that. And I know you guys read a lot of cowboy stories, David, in your house. And those, like there are some really good books about those. And you know who has a ongoing list of those is Martin Cawthron. He has this like passionate about this, like extremely passionate about this. The stories for boys that have been lost or not widely read. I think for older boys, I've never talked to a man who didn't, I mean, wasn't absolutely captivated by Lord of the Rings when they read it as like in that 12 to 15 age range, including my son. Like Jack read them before and liked them. And now at 13, almost 14, he's reading them again and he loves them. There's like, he's at that age that those just like, they are very masculine, like very masculine soul kind of books. And women read those too. I mean, everybody loves Lord of the Rings, but there's something specifically geared to the heroic spirit of a young man that's extremely formative. And then the other one that I've not read the whole thing of, but maybe you all have, is The Yearling. I think a lot of young men around the same age that I've talked to, I've never talked to somebody who wasn't profoundly formed by that book either, who was like, oh, meh, about The Yearling.
Yeah, Adam Andrews, our mutual friend, is a huge Yearling supporter, if I'm not mistaken.
I've never read that book. Is that a close read?
I haven't read it either. Like, is it of the quality to read on the show?
Yeah. And is it of like the... I've never thought about that before.
I haven't read the whole thing, but I mean, of people who, like, thoughtful Christian men who read it around the young teen years have, I think 100% of the guys I've talked to who've read that book say that you can't make it through without weeping.
No kidding.
Every single person I've talked to who's read that book has said, I like wept at the, not just like teared up, but there's, and I do know the story, but I'm not going to say it. But it makes a lot of sense. So anyway, consider it, or maybe you guys should read it.
It's not
like a 7-year-old boy book. It's more like a 12-year-old boy book.
I'm trying to think of any other books that I read at that age that were similar. I don't know. The thing is that a lot of books that I keep thinking of that are kind of like Western-y books, like The Yearling, for example, like girls like cowboys and horses too. So,
right. But it's different. It's a different, like, you guys liked Anne of Green Gables, but if you had read it if you'd read it at 8 years old, it probably wouldn't have had the same impact on you that it had on me. And I think that that's kind of, maybe I don't want to put words in her mouth, but that seems to be part of the soul of that question, which is like, what can captivate my son in the same way that I was captivated by Anne? I think even boys who read Anne of Green Gables like it, but it is the soul of it's very feminine. And I think that's kind of what the question's getting at. And I think that there are plenty of books that, you know, Little Britches, for example, like I would have never read that book of my own, but we liked it and listened to all of them as a family on Audible, every single one. And there are a lot of those after we read Little Britches on the show. There's Jack going out with his axe, trying to chop something down and build something.
I love it.
Lucy didn't do that. But there is something that's like boy about that idea of like building something to help your mom. And that I think is part of so many of those books we're talking about, even if girls enjoy them.
Yeah. And there's this desire for like to prove yourself and have adventure, even with younger boys. Like Coulter and Jeremiah are 8 and 7. And the other day we were at the park and Coulter's riding his bike around and he's trying to find the biggest hills he can ride on, because he wants that little bit of adventure. And Bethany's like, you know, essentially she's doing a good natured version of You'll Shoot Your Eye Out from Christmas Story. And she's just like, you know, moms always have a little bit of that, and dads too, to some extent, but moms always have a little bit of like, can't watch when their kid's doing something dangerous type thing. But you know, he needs that like ability to prove himself, if nothing else, to prove to himself that he can do something that he's scared of doing a little bit, you know? And I think sometimes that's what, I said that the soul of these books that become the go-to books for boys, because that's a big part of becoming a man, is being able to overcome things you're afraid of. Well, I mean, I guess it's also true of becoming a woman, I suppose, but so maybe I don't know what I'm talking about now that I'm thinking.
No, I think that is true. That there's a coming of age factor that of like overcoming, going on some kind of quest, overcoming some kind of difficulty that that is very, very boy. Like, boys are very drawn to that, the journey of the soul and the becoming a hero kind of thing. And if nowadays there's not, you know, they don't have to go out and shoot a deer to become a man, preview the yearling. You have to, in some ways stories can like awaken that and nourish that, even though we don't necessarily have that kind of thing in our culture the same way. Mm.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's keep going here. We have lots of questions to do. Quickly, Tim, in one word, do you think you'll read the rest of this series?
I only get one word. I want to say, I mean, like, we all have like lists. We have, I mean, I have, my list is so long of books that I want to read.
Do you think that it will go into the top 200 of the books that you will read?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Aaron wants to know, has a good question here that we need to spend some time thinking about. She says this: so some literary characters are truly transcendent, and Anne is one of them. By transcendent, I mean that they profoundly change those around them in a positive way. They change other characters and the reader, and they have a lasting effect on literature as a whole. Their goodness transcends their literary realm. Some examples I can think of besides Anne are The Bishop and Les Mis, Aslan, of course, and I'm sure there are a bunch I just can't think of as I type this. So here's my question, or really more of a point of discussion, because I don't know that if the how of this is answerable. But she says, how is it that authors can write such transcendent characters so well? What is it about the craft that allows an author to dream up a human being who can blow us away and edify a story so meaningfully? I mean, these authors are generally not remembered for their own virtue necessarily. So what do they tap into in order to create such virtuous characters? This maybe isn't a question that can be really answered, but would love to hear your thoughts on it. Tim, as a playwright, we'll start with you, because in theory anyway, you are trying to create characters that are truly transcendent, even, you know, at least that's the goal, right? So there's this question of how do authors do this? Like, what is it about the craft that allows it to happen? This is a really interesting meta question in some ways. So I'm curious what you think about this, because when you set out to write, that's something you would try to do, but is it something you actually try to do, or is it something that you have as like this thing you'd love to do that is an overarching goal, but you can't spend all your time thinking about it in that way? Does that make sense? What I'm asking?
I think so.
Or do you actually, like, on your goal for your play, do you actually, in your head or on a piece of paper or whatever, think, I need to create a character that is truly transcendent?
I think that, I don't know. For me, if I set out with that aim, I don't know. That seems like an Icarus goal, like just
right, yeah,
too high, too close to the sun.
Right. Yeah. And how can anyone think of themselves as someone who's capable of doing that?
Yeah.
From the get-go, right?
I will tell you what I think. Why I think Lucy Maud Montgomery succeeded so wildly in this book is because, first, the biggest obstacle that faced her is like the biggest obstacle that faces every writer, is that you have way too much freedom. You can say anything. You have a blank piece of paper and you can write anything in the world. And that is the most debilitating thing, because what you really need is you need limits, and you almost need, like, the harsher the limit, the better the book. Mm-hmm. And so by comparison, we've been talking about Crime and Punishment. It's a 700 page book. It's only talking about one thing, and it's talking about it over and over and over and over. And the complexity, like, blossoms up from the realism of that book. But it's like Raskolnikov obsessed with either committing a murder or trying to get away with it or understanding why he did it, you know, and that's what the book is about. 700 pages. And I think that's what, like, Anne of Green Gables is so good, because Lucy Maud Montgomery cut away all the stuff that did not belong in the book so that it's just focusing on Anne, this character, this beautifully drawn character. And all of the things that Lucy Maud Montgomery does not report upon in Avonlea, under the roof of Green Gables, at the school, at church, like, she doesn't report on, she only reports on this really specific character, and everything else is cut. Mm. that's not a terribly romantic answer, but I think that's like, that's the craft answer.
Hmm. That's interesting. Heidi, what do you think?
Heidi regrets to inform us that she has gone to fetch supplies.
Sorry, guys.
Were you fetching supplies? For a second.
No, my microphone or my computer connected to Jack's AirPods for a minute.
And so all of a sudden Jack is listening to close the unedited close reads.
Yeah, I was like, I wonder if Jack White is now representing the White family on close reads.
Maybe we should get his answer to this question.
So I will need a reminder. Oh, is it the transcendent characters question?
Right? Yeah. So the idea of, you know, this is a very interesting meta craft question. So how is it that authors are able to dream up a human being who can blow us away and edify a story so meaningfully?
Right. Yeah. I have no idea. Like, I think that this is such a good question, and it's, I've been thinking about it. I loved this question. I've been thinking about it for a couple of days. And I mean, I have some, like Tim, some ideas on the subject, but I really have no idea. And I think that maybe some speculation is that Lucy Maud Montgomery crafted Anne to be a kind of a tiny world that represented the way that she thinks that we can engage in life as an unfolding experience of becoming and engaging in goodness, truth, and beauty. And that in some ways, Anne is, she's fully human, but she's also a vessel for kind of all of the rich experiences of human life. And that is a transcendent thing. And many of the characters that we know and love in novels are like that too. Even in harder novels to read, like Raskolnikov is like that, right? Like he's a very transcendent character for a very different reason. But it all goes to that intense engagement with a fully human life. And kind of a mirror back to the reader of what it could be like to live like that, and an invitation to the deeper things of life. And I think that we respond to that, and the way we respond to that is almost always through an experience with art. It's not, you know, it's the unfolding narrative that we encounter through music or painting or through our own sufferings and joys and through the stories that we read and encounter in other people that kind of opens us up to that transcendent experience. And there are certain characters that invite us to it, but why one and not the other? You know, another one of the questions on the thread I kept connecting in my mind, which is, how do I get my kids to love this book? Like, I love it. You know, I read it to them and they didn't really like it that much. And so that's why I say, to a certain extent, I don't have any idea, because there's sometimes that happens to somebody through Anne, and another time it's through somebody else and another character, another story, and there's no telling. That's probably why we need so many stories and so much art, because there's no telling who's going to be that character that unlocks that transcendent experience in me. So I'm not, that's where I get kind of the mystery of it overwhelms me, that I'm like, I don't know, because for some people it's going to be Anne, for some people it's going to be somebody else. So just keep writing and keep reading, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, I think what Aaron's talking about is also called talent.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like, I think one of the things, like, great writers, the ability to create people comes from seeing the world in a specific way, like seeing the poetry at work in the world, being able to create characters and interactions that are believable and interesting at the same time. That's like a key part of it. And then, you know, that people that are that respond to what's going on around them in a way that is both interesting and believable, this, you know, at the same time. And like, that's it. There is a sort of mysterious, uncalculable talent that goes into being able to create characters like this. Like, I don't think you can teach a kid, like, so this is kind of my problem with, one of my problems with most creative writing programs, like curricula or whatever, that basically what the idea is you give them these ways of creating all this detail for characters, and then you give them ways of creating plot, and then they're supposed to put it all together like it's a puzzle, and then that's supposed to be a good story. But like, what's a good story is that there's a soul at the heart of the story. Mm-hmm. And that soul is both talent and instinct. Mm-hmm. And like, that's just practice. And so the while those tools are useful, like to suggest that that's what stories are, is for a writer, is not the way I think the approach should be done. But that's a different conversation for a different day. And there's just like, there's just a talent that gets developed over time. And certain writers just have the ability to see the world in a certain way and then put that into a certain, into language that the rest of the world also can find appealing. I mean, that's the sort of, you know, but you don't always know what people are going to find appealing. Like, think about a book like, have you guys read Stoner, I think, by John Williams?
No.
So this is a book, like a mid-century book written in the 60s or something like that. And it's having this huge moment right now. And like a lot of books, it's this very well-written book that kind of went undetected, you know, unknown at the time. And now people are coming back to it thanks to the New York Review of Books, and people are going, this book is genius. And so there's this, you know, you don't always know why a specific book catches on in a specific moment. And there's been lots of great books that have been lost to history. So there's a sort of mysteriousness about why certain characters in certain books connect with people at a certain time that allow it to, you know, become well-known or become big. And it's like that mystery tied with a uncalculable gifting that I think plays into that as well. Mm. That's why not just anybody can write truly transcendent characters. It's kind of like, by definition, why they surprise us and delight us. If all characters in every book were that sort of quote transcendent, they wouldn't be as delightful to us. Mm-hmm. It's like why you can't eat ice cream every day.
Right. There's one Michael Jordan, as we all as sports fans know. there's masters of the craft. And they can do it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, let's keep going here. Unless, Tim, did you want to add anything else now that Heidi and I have spoken?
No.
Okay, Nicole says, can anyone be or become a kindred spirit? Or do people have to kind of be born a kindred spirit? As the series continues, I was surprised by the wide variety of people Anne bestows the title kindred spirit. The conclusion I drew was that Anne creates kindred spirits wherever she goes and grows to love all sorts of people, even folks she wasn't a fan of initially. So do you think this is the idea that Montgomery is supporting, or are there particular people who Anne discovers to be kindred spirits and those who aren't?
I think it's both. I think one of the journeys that Anne goes on is she thinks that she's just going to find these kind of people. And they're going to be special people. And then as she grows and matures, that certainly happens. There are special people that she encounters and forms a relationship with, people that are closer to her, people who think like her or teach her something. And then there's just regular people that she kind of gains the eyes to see them. Like, and I think Miss Josephine Barry is one of those people in this particular book. And she's the one who makes Anne say, kindred spirits are not as rare as I thought. So I think one of the messages is, and I don't want to say moral, I really just mean one of the things that Montgomery is highlighting here is the Imago Dei. I don't know if she put it like that, but that there's something to love about everybody, and that part of Anne's, you know, awakening and becoming virtuous is learning to see that in everyone that she encounters. Mm. So I do think it's both.
Mm. Tim?
I can't improve on that answer.
Mary asks, how do you know how much to let an imagination run away with a child and the how-tos of placing healthy boundaries around imagination. Is there a booklet somewhere? Emoji, smiling emoji. I've got my own wild imagination to contend with, and now my seven-year-old girl's imagination as well, which is absolutely lovely. I can't imagine what I'd do if she had no imagination, but there is too much at times, isn't there? I think I sound a lot like Marilla most days. Get your head out of the clouds, get your work done, and while I'm at, there's a moral value stuck up the end of this, stuck on the statement. When did I become stodgy? That last question is rhetorical. But why don't we try answering the last question? And just maybe we can create a narrative for Mary Nelson's stodginess.
Well, Mary, I think a lot of it started when Mary started shopping at Costco instead of, I don't know, I give up. Uh-huh. I was going to try to like come up with
Aldi.
Something. Yeah, right, right.
As soon as you start buying in bulk, that's when the stodginess sets
in. Yeah, that's when it happens.
And literally everybody who's listening is like, hey,
that's me.
As they walk through Costco.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep.
Are people going to Costco still right now with the quarantine? I guess they probably are.
Yeah, but now you have to wear a mask. And so I'm not going anymore.
Is that a style thing? You're just like, I refuse to wear masks in public?
No, I just think, well, it doesn't matter what I think, but I'm...
Does anyone want to talk about the contending with the wild imagination of children?
No, I don't think we contend with it at all. 0%. I think that it is. I don't think we should place any. I don't think we should resist a child's imagination. I think that it's super important, which sounds like this is what Mary's doing with her daughter. The point of, there were lots of questions on the thread, which I loved, saying the same thing, which is, as a child, I was Anne, and now I feel like I relate more to Marilla. What do I do about that? And I think that it's just part
just keep
of,
reading, Anne.
Yes, exactly. I think that's exactly right. I do think that kids, shouldn't just go wander about as lonely as a cloud, to quote Wordsworth, and not do their math or pick up their room or help with the chores or whatever. I understand. I'm a mother too. That is an important part of existing in the world, is doing practical things. But I also think that life is, like, childhood is so short and childhood is so rich, and that I think we make room for a child's imagination as much as possible. And that we let them, and we let things like the haunted wood happen to them, right? Like, that's the thing. It wasn't Marilla's scolding that taught Anne to rule her imagination. It was an excess that's brought to the golden mean, as someone else commented on the thread, which I loved. It wasn't Marilla that helped her curb her imagination. It was herself. It was the natural course of life teaching her that and bringing it under the authority of a properly ordered soul. And that is, I think, as much as we can let that happen for our kids and not try to do it for them, the better.
I had a follow-up question. I forgot what it was.
Because I just talked right over you while you were trying
No, it was going to be good though. I'm pretty sure it was a good question. Tim, do you want to add anything?
No, I don't.
Is there a booklet somewhere though? She asked that.
Yeah, there is. And it's actually, who asked the question again? I forgot.
Mary, remember?
It's actually in the trunk, in that place where the spare tire and the tools go. It's actually like kind of found its way into there. So,
yeah, okay.
That's where.
So check there.
Yeah,
things do have a way of getting lodged back there.
Yeah.
You know, it's because when you go to Costco and you've just got like boxes and boxes of toilet paper and cereal and all those things,
it gets shoved over.
It's just over time, enough Costco trips, over time. You're becoming more and more stodgy, and the book is becoming pushing more and more underneath the floorboards of the trunk.
I hope Mary's shaking her fist at us right now. Yeah. You people, I trusted you.
Well, I mean, she did put it on a public page, so hey Tim, Tess wants to know if it's okay to unfriend a person that says they don't like this book.
There's actually a booklet for that also, Tess. And that one actually, strangely enough, that you have, there's that kind of foot locker that you keep in the laundry room. Mm-hmm. And yep. most of the stuff that you want to keep is actually inside the, but the booklet actually got shoved underneath the foot locker. So there's a code book on that. But the short answer, I'll just save you the read because the booklet is a little bit dry.
Yes. There's a reason that the book got pushed in the footlocker.
Right, it's not readable. The answer is yes.
I thought you were going to recommend putting the person in the footlocker, and I really did. Oh. And I was like, man, wow. Things are getting dark for
of imagination. Speaking of imagination that is running away with itself.
right.
Well, he's Tim, stuck in a basement. Sure. Like I know. You just never know. That does things. Damn. To people.
That's true. Wait, yeah. Is there a footlocker that you're? That's what made you think of it? That there's a footlocker in the laundry room?
No, I'll tell you what I'm looking at right now. I'm looking at a stainless steel basin labeled Tartar Farm and Ranch Equipment that has a rusty spigot and a wicker basket for, I don't know, garden gloves? That's what I'm looking at. It's not a footlocker, but it's of a similarly impliable material.
Well, I think we should combine the description of that thing that you just said with something I saw the other day while driving home. There was a car parked, there's this warehouse near my house, and there was a big van parked out front of it. And I thought, oh, there's a person sitting there on the passenger side. They must be waiting for something. So I didn't think anything else of it. Then an hour later, I drove back and everything was still exactly as it was. And I realized there was nobody else there. So I take a bit more of a nosy peek and I realized that it's not a real person. It's a dummy.
No.
What?
But that not like one that's made to look like, you know, what do you call those things at a department store that has the
like
clothes
a mannequin?
On it? What do you call
those? Yeah.
It's not like that. This one had like facial features and stuff and like fake hair. And it was sitting looking straight ahead in the passenger seat of this white van outside of this warehouse.
Whoa.
So I feel like if we take that, the thing that I saw yesterday, and combine it with this basement and the thing that you just described, we have the makings of a really interesting one-act play.
That is Southern Gothic right there. So
we do.
Yeah. Sometimes people have those so that they can drive in the
HOV lanes. David, it's time for a citizen's arrest.
That's law breaking. Not wearing your mask in Costco.
Right.
I think maybe I'll have to follow them though to be able to prove
clap the crime. That blue light on top of your Mercedes and make a citizen's
and
arrest.
Pull a Dwight Schrute. I want to go back to the fact that you think I drive a Mercedes.
I planted that there.
Yeah, thank you. Tess also asked another question, though. She said, I'd like to go back to the first episode when Tim asked the question about Anne and Holden. It was so intriguing to me, and then you guys never came back to it. It was something along the lines of who would handle each other's living situation best, Anne and Holden's world or Holden and Anne's world? Mm-hmm. Tim, please rephrase if I totally slaughtered the
question.
I think
that's right. That's how I remember the question, too.
Okay, so let's let you answer it then. So let's go back. You now that you've read both books back to back, who would handle the other character's situation better, Anne and Holden or Holden and Anne's world?
I am a believer that, how do I say this? There are two factors that shape like a person's destiny, or two forces, let's say, two energies. One is the energy from the outside in, and the other is the energy from the inside out. I think Holden is right on the verge of losing that energy that kind of like protects him from those outer forces that are just like overbearing and crushing. I think he's barely holding on. And I think that Anne had this incredible energy while she was at the she was in foster care, and then she got planted in like circumstances that helped her flourish. So all that's my preface. And I think we should always bet on the inner energy. I'm not trying to sound woo-woo. I just mean like inner energy sound like, gosh, Tim's been doing like a lot of yoga lately. I don't mean like that. I just mean like the impulse toward goodness, if you rely on external forces to make it happen, that's a crapshoot. But a character, a person who has like the drive toward goodness and it's born from within, I think Anne has a better chance of surviving whatever it is, 1947 downtown New York City, than Holden Caulfield in his present state stands at surviving Avonlea.
Totally agree.
Tim,
well said.
It took you 5 years to say, I don't mean to sound woo-woo. I mean,
wait, I don't sound woo-woo on this show, do I?
You should have prefaced that nearly five years ago when you first started coming on this podcast.
Because I sound woo-woo?
No, I'm just making fun. I'm just winding you up. I don't know.
Successfully.
I like Lisa's comment that the picture on the thread sums up her entire relationship with boys until she met her husband. And also, Tess's daughter asked a super important question that I think needs to be raised on this podcast.
Amen.
So Heidi, I need you to answer this one. Yep. Her daughter asked, I'm reading the Raspberry Cordial chapter, and Tess rightly says that it's worth restating here. This is going to be one of those PSA moments, I feel like. Is being drunk the same thing as having rabies?
It is such a good question.
Yes.
It is?
Yes. The same. I mean,
it's nothing like having rabies, like at all, but...
But it's also having rabies.
From what I've heard.
Because you've never had rabies before?
I've never had rabies before. So,
see what I did there?
Yep.
But, I mean, like, isn't, like, don't you got, I'm like, haven't you heard about people when they have too much to drink that they run around on all fours outside foaming at the mouth and barking at the moon? Isn't that kind of standard operating procedure?
Who are you hanging out with?
Hold on. The fact that is someone's drunken experience doesn't surprise me. The fact that that's what you think happens when someone has rabies does surprise me.
You know what my rabies like PSA was? Old Yeller.
Oh,
yeah.
Like I think point. I got everything that I know about rabies is from Old Yeller.
From Old Yeller.
Yeah. Well, just don't eat the bats. Let's
see
here.
That is the best question ever.
Yeah.
Carol asked a really interesting question that got a little bit of conversation on the thread. She says, when she read Anne of Green Gables as a girl, she assumed that Marilla and Matthew were married, were husband and wife. So why do you think Lucy Maud Montgomery made them brother and sister? And what might the further implications of that be? A couple people said that, that was a little confusing. Heidi, what do you think?
Well, it was pretty common in that day and age in earlier times for unmarried siblings to keep house together as adults, because you, in order to have a farm, you really do need a man and a woman, not just for gender roles, but for like the kind of work that is required for farming requires, you know, strong set of masculine shoulders. So it was more common. It wasn't a weird thing in earlier centuries. This would have been kind of an expected thing. And I think somebody said it might even have been your dad, David. I think this kind of gets to the thematic heart of it, is that Anne needed to come into a home with lonely people who were kind of that she could connect with and awaken from kind of a long slumber of the soul, and who could love her, and they can heal each other. So I think that that's two reasons.
Can you think of any books where, you know, like The Secret Garden, for example, you have this girl who comes in and it was an old man, right? Or
he's acted like an old man, but he was a widower.
That's right. Okay.
Yeah.
But you don't, there's not a lot of stories where some young character comes in, some young, you know, pleasant character comes in and makes the life of two married people better. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, like Heidi, for example, it's an old man, or it's like a grandfather or whatever. So Can you think of any stories where that is the scenario, where it's, say, a married couple whose marriage isn't going well and they bring some child comes along and makes things better?
It doesn't work as well, does it? It does. There's something about a lonely adult and a lonely child connecting and healing each other. That's like just a, makes a really good story. It's a lot different to take like, you know, a broken orphan and just make it a rescue story, right? Like stick them with some happily married couple and then they're everybody's fine. That's not normal. Like there's something about the idea of two lonely people or multiple lonely people kind of finding their way to learning how to love. And I think that was part of the reason why Matthew and Marilla, like if I was writing the story, that's how I would write it too. I wouldn't make them married because then you'd have to give them like an unhappy marriage and then you're back to the gritty stuff, right? So
yeah.
Yeah,
there's like a degree of seriousness in the stakes of an unhappy marriage that are difficult for young people to totally process. Whereas you can see two like brothers and sister, a brother and sister who are just lonely, that's like an easier concept for a 10-year-old to understand. Mm. It's much easier than understanding the difference between drunkenness and rabies.
Yes. I mean, I just feel like there's a pretty big difference. But
Tim, do you want to add anything to this?
No.
Okay. Okay. So let's see. Amanda asks, she says, I haven't read Anne as many times as Heidi, but I've read it a few times in the entire series once. And I'm wondering if this is the same for Heidi, the way that time and circumstance changes the characters that you relate to. So as a young girl and even a young mom, I related more to Anne, but reading it this time, I was much more moved by Marilla and the sadness combined with pride of her little girl growing up. Do you find that you, what did she say, identify with Marilla or other characters more than Anne? And Tim, I'd love to hear, well, I'll have a follow-up question for Tim after you answer that, Heidi.
I still identify most with Anne. Probably I'm in some state of arrested development whenever I read the book and earn $100. But I think what she said is really important, that as just like every good book, the characters, different characters come alive to us at different times, mm-hmm. and are kind of endowed with a new kind of meaning and level of compassion and empathy and relating. And I love that's kind of more of the mother's experience in reading this book, is to see Marilla as a human, not just as, you know, the dour moralistic woman that Anne fixes, right? But she's a very richly drawn character, and there's a lot of pathos in her, and Lucy Maud Montgomery really does a great job of characterizing her in that way.
So Tim, unless you want to answer that directly, I've got a follow-up question for you.
Follow-up question.
Okay, so we've talked a little about Marilla's instinct to need to moralize, you know, to feel like she has to teach Anne a lesson. But this is a book that has all kinds of adult characters who influence Anne in various ways. So there's Marilla, the way she interacts with Anne obviously changes, but she instills some discipline. You've got Matthew, who's so compassionate and loving towards her. You've got, Mrs. Allen and the teachers. And
is it Miss Stacy? Is that the name of the
Miss Stacy,
teacher?
Yeah. Yeah. And then, you know, even the way she looks at Diana's parents eventually and
Josephine Barry and
Exactly.
Yep.
Yeah. So there's all these different characters and Anne's perspective on them changes. And so I'm curious, how you think the book ultimately wants us to think about the way adult influences work on children. Like, is the book suggesting that there is a approach that is best to help children grow up to be, you know, well-adjusted, not arrested development people, people who are arrested developmentally?
I think it's really interesting that the person who we didn't mention is the, what is the maybe you did mention her, David, the wife of the pastor, the new pastor that moves in.
That's Mrs. Allen, right?
Yep. That's Mrs. Allen. You did mention her. I think that she like does as much for Anne as anyone. And it's because of kind of like, it's just who she is, the way that she comports herself in the world. She becomes this sort of ideal for what Anne can be. Not like with regards to like, I'm going to marry a pastor. Anne is a little bit kind of like reluctant to pursue that life. But just the way that she carries herself, and she comes to visit Anne after Anne has had the terrible fiasco when they come over to visit and she, you know, messed up the meal. And so I wonder if Lucy Maud Montgomery is saying it has less to do with the actual instruction, although maybe Miss Stacy is a counterexample to that, has less to do with the actual instruction, and it has more to do with like being who you are and the way that you carry yourself in the world. Anne sees that, and Anne seeks to kind of mimic that. So it's, you know, of course, we have to have instructors that teach us math. I love, by the way, that whenever we have to talk about sort of like a chore, I think all three of us always say something like, we have to have someone teach us math. We have to do our math. We've got to, math has to be done.
Hey. We know what kind of podcast this is.
Right. Well, I'm not doing it for the audience. I'm just like, it just readily comes to mind.
Sure. Exactly. Yeah.
So I don't know. That's my
math guess. Is like cleaning the toilets.
Yes. Yes.
I can't believe I just said that out loud. It's kind of should bury my head now.
I think she's recommending to us ideals.
Yeah. Yeah.
Ideal figures. And I know like my friend Tom, 10 years older than me, when I was growing up, when I was 13, 14, 15, he drove a red Alfa Romeo Spider that was a convertible. He was so funny and so cool. And he was also like a really serious Christian. And I had not seen those two things put together. Like a Christian who like just like had, he was just so fun. And it was an absolutely like life shifting thing. It wasn't the advice that Tom gave me, though he did give me advice and I'm sure it mattered, but it was more just like, I can be that kind of a person in the world. And I think that, I don't know, that's kind of my hunch about what Lucy Maud Montgomery is recommending to us.
Well, I think we're running out of time here. So I want to do one more comment here. We didn't talk a lot about the Lady of Shalott scene, you know, kind of, we got into some other things. And Amy Edwards asks on the thread, she has a comment about it. She says, as you shouted, you moved on toward batting around if Lucy Maud Montgomery was moralizing and Anne was repenting of her imagination and wondering if maybe Anne's speech to Marilla was Lucy Maud Montgomery's voice. But I was still thinking about the reenactment of Elaine and the remarks about Tennyson's poem. I grew up reading this book like Heidi did, but haven't reread it in a long time. However, about a month ago, I studied Tennyson's poem with my kids and parsed it sort of like Anne's class did. And I started thinking about how the Lady of Shalott sits and weaves her web until finally she sets out to see the world firsthand, not through the mirror any longer, and to really live life, except she is cursed and must die. Is this the point? Is Anne turning the corner here and stepping forward into no longer fantasizing about her life, but really living it? And Anne has misunderstood at this point what it means to grow up. She thinks she has to repent of her imagination, but really she's just moving into the more real. I never thought about this incident in this light before, probably because I just love the romance of it, the romance of the pretending and the romance of Sweet Gilbert. And also, I really didn't know Tennyson's poem much at all beyond the loving the sound of it all those years of my youth when I read and reread Anne. So what do you think? So Heidi, I wanted to make sure we at least touch on this scene. You talked a lot about how you love this scene.
I love this scene.
And so I think we should at least touch on it a little bit more than we actually did on the show. So do you want to comment on it and what Amy's saying here?
Yeah, I think I think this is one of those scenes that you can read just as a delightful part of the story, and that's perfectly fine. Or you can read it with a little bit more of a commentary to it, as she's doing. And I think that works too. Anytime you have characters, because of my literary training, anytime you see a character falling in water, right? I mean, what are we all thinking? There's a baptism, there's a rebirth, there's some kind of like change that's happening to this character. And so I do think that that's...
I was just thinking, why doesn't she not know how to swim? That's all I was thinking.
Well, that's a fair question. And I've always wondered, because I remember reading it and being like, well, why don't you just swim? Like, what's the big deal?
Oh, you didn't know that Canadians can't swim?
I guess I didn't. It wasn't part of my education, but now I am older and wiser.
They live on an island.
You would think that they would know how to swim. You would think.
Yeah. Anyway.
So I do think that there's, first of all, Montgomery loves the Romantic poets, loves Tennyson, and loves that any kind of, this kind of poetry, which Tennyson wasn't really a romantic, but he was a Victorian, but this kind of like overblown imaginative telling the story, idolizing and idealizing nature and love, like that was the poetry that Lucy Maud Montgomery loved. And so this particular poem, I think, was chosen on purpose because it's one of her favorites. She wrote about this in her letters. And then it was, so there's a bit of a commentary on education, as she brought up in her comment, that there's, I love the fact that the commentary on education is you can parse and you can analyze and you can do that with this poem, with these poems, but when it comes down to it, it's still going to have a hold on children in an imaginative way. And they're going to try to make something out of it that's wholly their own. And I like that. I think that that's one of the things I love about this scene. And then the idea of her being carried away, like literally carried away into deep waters through her imaginative experience and then almost getting lost there. It's almost, there is almost like a death that's happening there. And then along comes this boy who is going to become a huge part of her life and she can't see it. Like she can't see that he's rescuing her from being kind of lost in the waters of over imagination. And if you've read more of the series, you know that Gilbert's rival in a later book is Anne's like romantic hero of her, and almost the same thing happens, that she's almost carried away from the true love because she's so enamored, falsely seduced by a romantic ideal. And she almost misses Gilbert completely. And so she keeps repeating this kind of pattern, but there is a little bit of a paradox that I find very more deep than you would think, which is the question of, yes, you can be carried away by it, but at the same time, it's still good in itself. And so it's not a moral that she's trying. I think Montgomery is wrestling with that throughout her books. That there is kind of a paradox and a mystery to that, that it's not a bad thing to be carried away by your imagination. And yet it could be a bad thing to be carried away by your imagination. I'm not sure she knows how to reconcile those things. So she puts it in kind of this mysterious way in this particular scene.
It also thrusts, it also just brings Gilbert back into the story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So in that way, it's kind of a turning point. Like it brings her back into focus for us as readers, which makes her response to him that much more dramatic, right? Because it makes him more appealing, so that all the things you're saying about the way she almost misses him and all that can become more, you know, dramatic. Like there's more dramatic tension that that gets added to the story. Tim, do you want to add anything?
No.
Well, go ahead.
That's great.
I think that this is a low point for Anne. I love this scene, but it's also her, this, like she's mean in this scene to Gilbert. And she's, you know, we all find Anne so, so delightful, and she is. She's wonderful. But she has a mean streak to her. And it's this attachment to her romantic ideal that drives her in the lowest points of her life throughout her growing up years. And Montgomery doesn't shy away from that, which I really like. She confronts that and she makes Anne do things that aren't right. And this particular thing is a low point for her. So I don't think we should miss that either.
Well,
and that's all I have to say about that.
We've been, no, it's not. It's all we have, all the time we have for the, do either of you have any final thoughts, because we should wrap this up? And, Tim, do you want to add anything?
David, I don't have a final thought about Anne of Green Gables, but I do want to do a brief advertisement for the play's The Thing. Sarah Jane Bentley and I are going to record our second episode of Coriolanus, one of Shakespeare's best plays, like maybe even a top three play. Sarah Jane and I both agree on that. And it's a play that very few people, even like Shakespeare fans, no. So we are trying to do it justice. And also, as an addendum to that, the Close Reads listenership is largely female, which we're very happy about. But I would love if we could kind of like increase the number of male listeners. And I think that Coriolanus might be, I'm not going to say like it's an easy way in, it's a hard way in, but this sort of like warrior ethic of the main character Coriolanus, there is a very masculine kind of ideal. And so watching maybe the Ralph Fiennes movie of Coriolanus as a companion to the plays The Thing might be a way for some of the guys who have been loitering in the suburbs of Close Reads or the plays The Thing, it might be a way for them to kind of like enter the city.
We'll have to do a cowboy book.
Yeah, we should do another cowboy book. Like, what about, I mean, like, I don't know. Lonesome Dove. It's long, but Lonesome Dove might be the one.
Maybe. It's very readable, though. It is long, though. Boy, it's long. Tim, yes, I was also going to mention that you guys, you and Heidi, did the whole play of As You Like
As
It.
As You Like
all
It.
Five acts.
Yeah.
All those,
and has that know, been released yet?
Yeah, they're all released. So all those have been, they're out on the Plays the Thing feed.
Wonderful.
So head over to, you can binge listen to Heidi and Tim talking about As You Like It, which, and I highly recommend you do that. As I've mentioned, this is one of my favorite Shakespeare plays, maybe my favorite comedy. And so it's a good listen. You should check it out. So you can head over to the Plays the Thing to subscribe. And when you're there, you should rate and review. If you want to rate and review this podcast wherever you listen, we wouldn't complain. We'd certainly be grateful for that. And then, of course, we also have the Daily Poem, which is going on. Yesterday, I recorded a little poem with a special guest, my 8-year-old, and he chose to talk about William Blake's The Tiger.
Oh, burning so bright.
He talked about Tiger and brought up Calvin and Hobbes. So, you know, if you are a fan of either of those things, then check out the Daily Poem. Well, I guess that's it for this episode. Thanks for being here as always. Next week, we will dive into Graham Greene's The End of the Affair. And again, we will talk about book one, and that will go up one week from today on May 5th. Heidi, Tim, it's been a pleasure talking about Anne of Green Gables. Heidi, thanks for bringing your enthusiasm.
No.
That was amazing. Thank you for saving that for the last moment.
And Tim, thank you for bringing your...
I want to hear this.
I don't have one.
Yeah, we can't do it. I can't
I don't have
something
one.
Out of Gilbert.
If I had actually been saving enthusiasm for 5 weeks, then I would have thought of something for Tim, but I just thought of enthusiasm in the spot. And so I
awesome.
Wasn't capable. It wasn't capable of coming up with something for Tim... Well, someone's got to give us one. Someone's got to give us
enthusiasm.
You can't just yes, add
I
the.
I did.
Never mind. We'll just go.
Jaws of defeat. Right.
Well, exactly. Well, for Heidi White and for Tim McIntosh, I'm David Curran. Thanks so much for listening. Till next time, happy reading.